Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 27, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Shelby County v. Holder. The question in this case is whether Congress's 2006 decision to reauthorize Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act under the pre-existing coverage formula of Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act exceeded its authority under the 14th and 15th Amendments, and thus violated the 10th Amendment and Article 4 of the United States Constitution. To discuss the case, we have Mike Carvin, who is a partner at Jones Day. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Carvin.
Today, the Supreme Court heard arguments in Shelby County versus Holder, which involved a challenge to the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was originally enacted in 1965 as a very temporary five-year fix to some of the enormous problems that the Jim Crow South had created for black voters. And it imposed this extraordinary procedure on those southern jurisdictions and a few others of requiring that they pre-clear, that is, come to the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., and have the Justice Department find that all of the voting changes they were proposing were free of any discriminatory purpose and effect. There's another provision, much more important provision, of the Voting Rights Act called Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination throughout the United States. It's not just limited to these selected jurisdictions. So the question was, in 2013, is there still an ongoing need for this temporary solution to the problem in the South of the 1960s? And it seemed clear that the court, at least the majority of the court, was willing to say that Congress had imposed this onerous burden on the covered jurisdictions without an adequate justification, because they were using evidence and examples from the 1960s and 1970s, when a unanimous Supreme Court had said 3 years ago they need to show that there are current needs for Section 5, not based on ancient history. And I think the line of questioning raised three very important points, which I think signal strongly that the court is willing to strike down Section 5. The first point is Justice Kennedy repeatedly asked, isn't Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act adequate to deal with any discrimination that remains in the covered jurisdictions, so that you don't need to add on this extraordinary Section 5 point? And he said that's particularly true because there's a provision that if you find that jurisdictions are recalcitrant or particularly bad actors, you can impose on them a preclearance requirement individually. And the thrust of Justice Kennedy's questions, which the government was wholly unable to answer, was since Section 2 not only prohibits unconstitutional discrimination, that is, purposeful discrimination, but broadly prohibits anything with a discriminatory result, this is a very effective prophylactic means of eliminating discrimination in voting. We know it's effective because Congress relies on Section 2 exclusively in all the non-covered jurisdictions to get at the problem. And the Solicitor General and the NAACP were utterly unable to explain why the differences between the covered jurisdictions and the non-covered jurisdictions were so extreme that you needed this special remedy in the covered jurisdictions but not in the uncovered jurisdictions. Justice Alito also made the point that the decision to keep the 9 covered states under Section 5 is inherently irrational because it's based on entirely old election results from 46 years ago. Justice Alito asked, would it have been proper in 1965 to look at 1919 election results, i.e. 46 years ago, and would that have been rational? And the government had to admit that that sort of thing was not acceptable. Finally, some of the justices who seemed to be in favor of renewing Section 5 were trying to engage in damage control by arguing that, look, even if Section 5 on its face generally is not justified, surely it's justified in places like Alabama, where they allege that there's particularly egregious cases of discrimination that persist today. And the response from both the justices and the advocate for Shelby County were quite convincing, that it doesn't make any sense to look at individual counties like Shelby County when you're deciding whether a national law of national application is unconstitutional. to paraphrase some of the examples, if Congress had said that all states east of the Mississippi River are covered by this special provision, it wouldn't make any sense to say that Shelby County can be included just because it's east of the Mississippi. If the formula itself for determining who's subject to these special preclearance requirements can't be justified in the abstract, there's no reason to look at individual counties within the broader group that's being burdened. Plus, which, of course, it would make no sense, because under that rationale, literally every county that's subject to Section 5 would have to have an individualized determination of its current degree of discrimination, which Congress didn't authorize, and the judiciary would have to make up a test for whether or not the discrimination was sufficiently bad to keep them in or keep them out. And finally, even the Solicitor General admitted in response to questions, if some county from Alaska, which doesn't have Alabama's history of discrimination but is a covered jurisdiction under Section 5, had come forward, then the act would be struck down. Well, if the act was struck down, it would also strike it down for Alabama. So all of these efforts to say that there could be some kind of individualized inquiry county by county didn't seem to gain any traction and certainly weren't sufficient to justify continued application of Section 5 nationally. The final reason I think that the court will strike down Section 5 is because the court looked at this issue 3 years ago and determined that they weren't going to decide the constitutionality of Section 5, but 8 justices, plus Justice Thomas, who thought the law was unconstitutional, all of them made it clear that they thought there were serious constitutional questions involving Section 5, and they gave Congress very pointed hints that if you're going to try and continue Section 5, you need to come up with a formula that's addressed to real distinctions and not manufactured distinctions. And in that case, they said there's more similarity between the covered jurisdictions and the not covered jurisdictions than differences. Presumably, the court anticipated that Congress, unlike what it did in 2006, would take a serious look at whether or not the Section 5 burdens were really targeted at jurisdictions that needed this special Section 5 oversight, and the Congress didn't do anything in the wake of that opinion 3 years ago. So I think it confirms what Justice Kennedy asked at oral argument. If you put states under a federal receivership, surely there's got to be some mechanism for figuring out whether or not the prior sins have been expurgated, and if so, that federal receivership needs to end. And since the court gave Congress every opportunity to justify the continued existence of the federal receivership, and Congress completely ignored that invitation, I would suspect strongly that the court, having given Congress a second bite at the apple, is now going to strike down the law as facially unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.